Education Report, Pete Musto will tell us about some college students in the United States who are struggling with anxiety, depression, or other mental health issues. Then you will hear Words and Their Stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Anna Mateo will tell us about a Greek word that some Americans use. She'll tell us what it means in American English. And finally, we will present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember and Bob Doty will tell us about American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started.
Last time, we examined the growing number of college students seeking help for mental health issues. We also shared the stories of two students, Georgia and Jason. Georgia began attending classes at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, in 2010. But the pressure of succeeding and worrying about what she would do after college led to her misusing a medication called Adderall. Georgia cut back on eating and sleeping and began to suspect friends and strangers of spying on her. Eventually, a doctor found that Georgia was suffering from bipolar disorder, a condition that causes unusual changes in emotions and energy levels. Jason began considering suicide after his parents ended their marriage and the deaths of his grandmother and best friend. But he did seek help from a therapist and decided to stop studying at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County in 2008. Georgia and Jason are just two examples of the many students struggling with anxiety, depression, and other mental health issues. David Reitz has ideas about why young people are having such a hard time. Reitz directs counseling and psychological services at the Rochester Institute of Technology in New York State. He is also a governing board member of the Association for University and College Counseling Center Directors, a group of over 800 college counseling directors worldwide. Reitz says the current generation of people in their 20s, often called millennials, cannot cope with problems the same way that other generations did. Millennials are less able to solve interpersonal conflict or to accept criticism, he says. These skills, he adds, are abilities that employers like their workers to have. However, millennials are not to blame, Reitz says. Access to information about both good and bad aspects of life increased greatly over the last 30 years. He believes the parents of millennials caused their children to worry more because they worried more.
I suspect that the parents of millennials parented in a very different way than previous generations. The parents of millennials parented with higher levels of anxiety. The parents of millennials were raised with much more exposure to threats within their communities, throughout the country, even now more internationally.
Reitz says parents of millennials spent more time supervising their children than other parents did. As a result, these young people had fewer chances to learn how to take risks or solve conflicts themselves. He adds that social media also has had an influence. websites such as Facebook and Instagram cause people to compare themselves to others in unfair ways. But Richard McKean warns against making claims about how every member of a generation thinks or feels.
There are certainly many changes in terms of the nature of neighborhoods and communities and family life and other issues over time that would make it hazardous to generalize about a whole generation of young people.
McKean is the chief of suicide prevention for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration, known as SAMHSA. SAMHSA is a federal government agency that studies mental health issues in the U.S. Last June, the agency released a study of over 135,000 young people between the ages of 18 and 25. It found that young people in college are less likely to commit suicide with a plan than those who are not in college. In other words, college students may suffer from mental health issues, but their conditions may not be as severe as those who are not in college. McKean also notes millennials are not the first generation of young people to face severe mental health issues. In the 1980s and 1990s, the suicide rate among youth in the U.S. reached levels that experts had never seen before. All the experts VOA contacted for this story said they are pleased that more young people are seeking help for mental health issues. In fact, Pennsylvania State University's Ben Locke says a common concern is that colleges and universities do not have enough resources for students in need. Locke is Penn State's Counseling Services Director. But David Reitz at the Rochester Institute of Technology notes that most colleges have experts whom students can meet with to discuss their problems. Therapy groups are common as well. Richard McKean of SAMHSA adds that many other student support workers are now being trained to identify signs of mental health issues in students. Georgia never used the mental health support services McGill University offered. She finished her degree program in 2014 and stopped taking all medication over a year ago. Georgia says she feels much better, but she wishes she had been more willing to use the services at the school. Jason did not use the mental health services his school offered either, but he did feel that speaking to the leader of the Jewish Culture Center on his school's campus helped him. Jason decided to return to the University of Maryland, Baltimore County in 2012. He will complete his degree after one final semester this year. The path to improving one's mental health is never easy. But Jason says if students start to feel they have a problem, they should know there is nothing wrong with asking for help. I'm Pete Musto.
Thanks, Pete.
Hello, this is the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this weekly program, we explore the origin and usage of common expressions in American English. For example, sometimes when Americans do not understand something, they say, "It's all Greek to me." That saying does not make sense, of course, if you actually speak Greek, but today we are going to talk about a Greek word and what it means in American English. Eureka is Greek for I have found it. It is something we say when we have figured out a solution to a complex problem. Eureka is a kind of interjection. Interjections are the quick, short words or sounds we cry out when we are feeling intense emotion. They can express pain, surprise, anger, or joy. These kinds of words are also called exclamations. Someone cries "Eureka!" to express excitement when that person makes a discovery. When you finally find the answer to something you have been working on for a long time, nobody would blame you for yelling "Eureka!" from the rooftops. The story behind "Eureka!", however, is somewhat of a guess. Some say it goes all the way back to the time of ancient Greece and an inventor named Archimedes. The king of Syracuse, Hydro II, gave Archimedes a difficult problem to solve. The king wanted to know if goldsmiths had used pure gold to make his crown. This problem troubled Archimedes. How could he learn if the crown was pure gold? One day, he stepped into the water of a bathtub. He saw that the water flowed over the top of the tub. The water that overflowed was displaced by his body. When Archimedes climbed in and out of the bath, he carefully studied the displaced water. He noticed that the more his body sank into the water, the more water was displaced. This meant that the displaced water measured his volume exactly. Suddenly, Archimedes realized how he could test the gold in the king's crown. He knew that gold is heavier than silver, so he reasoned that a crown mixed with silver would have to be bulkier than one made only of gold if both weighed the same. Therefore, it would displace more water than a crown of pure gold. Archimedes allegedly became so excited by this discovery that he jumped out of the bath and ran naked through the city streets, shouting, "Eureka! Eureka!" meaning, "I have found it! I have found it!" In another version of the story, the king gives a different puzzle to Archimedes to solve. Archimedes must figure out how to build a massive ship that won't sink. Again, he supposedly makes his discovery in a public bath. Both are great stories, but most likely Archimedes never said "Eureka!" And who knows if he really ran through the streets naked? What we do know is that Archimedes discovered the law of buoyancy, or what engineers still call today the Archimedes principle. But let's go back to "Eureka!" as an expression. The expression "Eureka!" has another historic connection to gold. This time it happened during more modern times in the United States. During the California Gold Rush, prospectors looking for gold in the Californian hills were said to yell, "Eureka! I found it!" when they struck gold. To this day, California's state motto is "Eureka!" The word "Eureka!" also lives on in scientific communities. The American Association for the Advancement of Science calls its breaking scientific news site "Eureka Alert." However, these days, saying "Eureka!" as a way of expressing an amazing discovery is out of style. One interjection that has replaced "Eureka!" is "aha." Both "eureka moments" and "aha moments" are used to describe the times we are experiencing a breakthrough discovery. Albert Einstein arriving at his theory of relativity and Isaac Newton getting hit on the head with an apple are both examples of eureka moments. Here are examples on how to use it in everyday conversation. If your classmate or work colleague seems to be about to discover something big and important, others might warn you to stay away. Don't bother her, she's having a eureka moment. Sometimes we just say, light bulb. When a character in comics or in an animated film has a really great idea, sometimes a light bulb appears above their head. So saying light bulb is a funny way of saying, I just had a brilliant idea. And that brings us to the end of another Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Thanks, Anna. Now we present The Making of a Nation. This week in our series, Steve Ember and Bob Doty tell us about American arts and popular culture during the 1930s. Hard economic times and social conflict have always offered a rich source of material for artists and writers. A painter's colors can show the drying of dreams or the flight of the human spirit. A musician can express the tensions and uncertainty of a people in struggle. The pressures of hard times can be the force to lift a writer's imagination to new heights. So it was during the 1930s in the United States. The severe economic crisis, the Great Depression, created an atmosphere for artistic imagination and creative expression. The common feeling of struggle also led millions of Americans to look to films, radio, and other new art forms for relief from their day-to-day cares.
The most popular sound of the 1930s was a new kind of music, swing music. And the king of swing was a clarinet player named Benny Goodman. Benny Goodman and other musicians made swing music extremely popular during the 1930s. Swing music was a new form of jazz. Many of its first players were black musicians in small, unknown groups. It was only when more well-known white musicians started playing swing music in the middle 1930s that the new music became wildly popular.
One reason for the popularity of swing music was the growing power of radio during the 1930s. Radio had already proven in earlier years that it could be an important force in both politics and popular culture. Millions of Americans bought radios during the 1920s. But radio grew up in the 1930s. Producers became more skillful in creating programs. And actors and actresses began to understand the special needs and power of this new electronic art form. Swing music was not the only kind of music that radio helped make popular. The 1930s also saw increasing popularity for traditional classical music by Beethoven, Bach, and other great musicians. In 1930, the Columbia Broadcasting System began a series of concerts by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra on Sunday afternoons. The next year, the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, began weekly opera concerts.
In 1937, NBC asked Arturo Toscanini of Italy to lead an orchestra on American radio. Toscanini was the greatest orchestra leader of his day. Millions of Americans listened at Christmas time as Toscanini and the NBC Orchestra began playing the first of 10 special radio concerts. It was a great moment for both music and radio. For the first time, millions of average Americans were able to hear classical music by great musicians as it was being played.
Music was an important reason why millions of Americans gathered to listen to the radio during the 1930s. But even more popular were a series of weekly programs with exciting or funny new actors. Families would come home from school or work and laugh at the foolish experiences of such actors as Jack Benny, Fred Allen, George Burns, Edgar Bergen, and W.C. Fields. Radio helped people forget the hard conditions of the Great Depression, and it helped to bring Americans together and share experiences.
Swing music, classical music, great comedy programs. The 1930s truly were a golden period for radio and mass communications. But it was also during this period that Hollywood and the American film industry became much more skilled and influential. In previous years, films were silent. But the talkies arrived in the 1930s.
Directors could produce films in which actors could talk. Americans reacted by attending film theaters by the millions. It was a great time for Hollywood. The films had exciting new actors: Spencer Tracy, Betty Davis, Katharine Hepburn, the young Shirley Temple. The most famous film of the period was Gone with the Wind, with Clark Gable and Vivian Leigh in the starring roles of Rhett Butler and Scarlett O'Hara.
No, I don't think I will kiss you. Although you need kissing badly. That's what's wrong with you. You should be kissed and often, and by someone who knows how.
Oh, and I suppose you think you're the proper person.
I might be, if the right moment ever came.
Directors in the 1930s also produced such great films as It Happened One Night, Mutiny on the Bounty, and The Life of Emile Zola.
The success of radio and films, as well as the Depression itself, caused problems for many American newspapers during the 1930s. The trouble was not so much that readers stopped buying newspapers. It was that companies talked about their products through advertisements on radio instead of buying advertising space in newspapers. Nearly half of the nation's independently published newspapers either stopped publishing or joined larger companies during the 1930s. By World War II, only 120 cities had competing newspapers.
Weekly and monthly publications faced the same problem as daily newspapers: increased competition from radio and films. Many magazines failed. The two big successes of the period were Life magazine and the Reader's Digest. Life magazine had stories for everyone about film actors, news events, or just daily life in the home or on the farm. Its photographs were the greatest anywhere. Reader's Digest published shorter forms of stories from other magazines and sources.
Most popular books of the period were like the films coming from Hollywood. Writers cared more about helping people forget their troubles than about facing serious social issues. They made more money that way, too. But a number of writers in the 1930s did produce books that were both profitable and of high quality. One was Sinclair Lewis. His book, It Can't Happen Here, warned of the coming dangers of fascism. John Steinbeck's great book, The Grapes of Wrath, helped millions understand and feel in their hearts the troubles faced by poor farmers. Erskine Caldwell wrote about the cruelty of life among poor people in the southeastern United States, and James T. Farrell about life in Chicago.
The same social concern and desire to present life as it really existed also were clear in the work of many American artists during the 1930s. Thomas Benton painted workers and others with strong, tough bodies. Edward Hopper showed the sad streets of American cities. Reginald Marsh painted picture after picture of poor parts of New York City. The federal government created a program that gave jobs to artists. They painted their pictures on the walls of airports, post offices, and schools. The program brought their ideas and creativity to millions of people. At the same time, photography became more important as cameras improved in quality and became more movable. Some photographers, like Margaret Burke White and Walker Evans, used their cameras to report the hard conditions of the Depression.
All this activity in the arts and popular culture played an important part in the lives of Americans during the 1930s. It not only provided relief from their troubles, but expanded their minds and pushed their imaginations. The tensions and troubles of the Great Depression provided a rich atmosphere for artists and others to produce works that were serious, foolish, or just plain fun. And those works, in turn, helped make life a little better as Americans waited, worked, and hoped for times to improve. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Thanks for spending some time with us today.